I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books on political theory and social philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Zinya Graf, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the National University of Singapore. We're discussing her 2021 book, The Humanity of Universal Crime, Inclusion, Inequality, and Intervention in International Political Thought, from Oxford University Press. Her research is at the intersection of political theory, international studies, and international law, and she has published several articles on international law and the concept of humanity. So first of all, Zinya Graf, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for taking the time, Jeff.
Yeah, I love the book. It's a great analysis of a really important concept, the notion of crimes against humanity. We'll start to talk about that in just a minute. And you take us through the concept very well, take us through the history of its development, and have a lot of great things to say. So thank you for the book, first of all. Let me ask just right off the bat, what motivated you to write the book in the first place?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. No, that's a good question. And perhaps I should say that this being my first book, it came to some extent out of a doctoral dissertation, right? I say to some extent because there were a lot of changes. So motivations, I would say there were two. There was perhaps a political motivation and then a scholarly motivation. The political one, of course, came first. The scholarly came later because I didn't know what I was doing for a long time. So the political motivation was the development of international criminal law, or let's say the increasing institutionalization and practice of international criminal law as opposed to international human rights law in the 2000s, I would say, between sort of 2000 and 2010. So that was the political bit. Then scholarly terms, what I noticed is that within political theory, and especially within the history of liberalism and proto-liberalism, rights, natural rights, and human rights, and to some extent, international human rights law, were very, very well explored and very well theorized. The same was not true for criminality and humanity. So I was curious how the concepts of criminality and humanity in the history of political liberalism would complement those of rights and the individual. And then I started digging, and I found that over time, important people like Locke started using words that nowadays we would recognize as the phrase crimes against humanity. So that was the motivation how I got started with the project.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, let's talk about that notion of crimes against humanity, because it's a term that I don't think I've heard it in a couple years anyway, but certainly in the like 1990s and 2000s, hear it quite a bit. I mean, can you talk about the history of that phrase, crimes against humanity, what it refers to, you know, how it's different from crimes against individuals, for example, or groups, and maybe just give us a couple examples.
Okay. Yeah, sure. That's a really important question. Actually, crimes against humanity has come up again recently in the news about the pandemic and about vaccine patenting, for instance, that the withholding and the acquisition of patenting of vaccines and the attending maldistribution of vaccinations is a crime against humanity. So, okay, but you asked about the concept. So those are all really crucial questions. And there are a couple of distinctions that perhaps we should make for the sake of clarity. So in the book, of course, I take a cue from crimes against humanity as it's nowadays adjudicated under international criminal law, or also in domestic courts, of course. But then I also use the term universal crime, which is in the title of the book. So, and universal crime I use as an umbrella concept to broaden the notion of crimes against humanity as we have it nowadays in positive international law. Now, so you asked about history. So again, there's sort of the question is, what do we mean by this history? So one way to write a history of crimes against humanity is to say, okay, we have this norm in positive international criminal law right now, as it is such defined, and it's a long and very, very, very specific definition that to some extent comes out of the Nuremberg trials. And you could write a history of that, how these ideas, these types of violence, you know, deportations, displacements, murder, killing, torture, how when those types of violence are performed as part of a state or organizational policy with the intention to enact such a policy, then we're talking about the international legal norm of crimes against humanity. That's not so much what I'm doing in the book. In the book, I'm looking really just sort of how the actual phrase circulates in political theory texts. So I don't look at positive international law. I look at how political theorists over time have used this idea that there is something called an offense offense against mankind, an injury to humanity, a crime against humanity, something like that. So that's why I use universal crime, right? To say there is this basic idea that humanity can be injured as a whole, as an entire subject by certain acts. And examples is tricky because I don't really look at the content of these articulations of universal crime because they vary so crazily over history. Like Grotius thought that circumcision was an offense against mankind. I mean, why should we consider that, you know? So examples for universal crime is harder to make a good case for, but what interested me is just this idea that humanity is a collective subject that can be universally offended by certain acts. And that's what I try to capture more broadly by universal crime as it meanders through the history of political thought.
Yeah, and just underline a point that you made in the your introductory remarks about your motivation, which I find interesting in this connection, is precisely this point that you're focused on humanity, harms, crimes against humanity as a subject, whereas usually in the liberal tradition, we think of it in terms of individuals. Right. So is this, we'll get into the details in a minute, but, you know, is this the notion of, you know, harms against humanity? Is this sort of central, you think, to the tradition, or sort of a periphery, you know, I mean, something we missed, or, you know, that's crucial, or, or, you know, how central, I guess, is it to thinkers like Grotius, Locke, and so forth?
That's a really good question. I think I should say that it's very central and therefore my book is super important. So let me maybe not say quite that much. Let me say a little bit less. I do think that in the history of political liberalism, that humanity and the individual sort of run on two tracks. Yeah, and of course they speak to some extent, they speak to each other in the sense that the individual, as much as humanity, is a normatively valuable subject that must be protected and defended, and violently defended on many, many occasions, actually. So in terms of how important is humanity, well, I think one really important thing that I'm trying to get at by looking at criminality is that a crime presupposes a community that is injured, not just a concrete person or a certain number of individuals, right? So murder is a crime, it's not a tort. Murder is a crime that, of course, affects the concrete victims, but it also injures and ruptures the normative bonds that constitute a community. Yeah, so that's why criminal trials operate differently than civil trials, for instance. That's why a rights violation is different from a crime. So in that way, really was what intrigued me in studying this notion, is that there is this existence in political liberalism, say, where humanity as a collective subject is in operation. And that I thought was understudied. And given these sort of ubiquitous invocations of humanity, you know, all the time, you know, in the war on terror and, you know, humanitarian intervention, it got all these sort of really big arguments about the legitimacy of political violence, they so often invoke humanity rather than just the human individual. So, and I think that's where the importance come from, is that humanity just circulates in political discourses. And it is real in these political theoretical texts as well, but is not as well explored because of the methodological individualism that has shaped our understanding of liberalism. So how important that is, maybe, I don't know. I don't really want to say that. I mean, I thought it was important, but maybe I'm wrong.
So. I think it's super important. I mean, in part, I mean, just thinking about it here, I mean, it hasn't kind of a flavor of an ancient way of thinking in the sense that the ancients typically a regular way of conceiving of harms, that is a harm against the community first and foremost, and then secondarily against individuals. And, you know, so typically we conceive of the liberal tradition as upending that and rejecting the, you know, man as a political animal kind of view and thinking of a kind of atomism. But you're right. I mean, especially in Locke, there's a really important kind of sociality of, you know, human beings at bottom, that kind of community of humanity that he's concerned about. So, yeah, well, I think so.
Good. Look,
yeah, I think that's important.
All right.
Okay, so just that, just to talk about the thesis of your book here, to get to that, as I understand what you're doing, so you're challenging sort of a legalistic approach to the concept of crime against humanity, right?
Yeah.
That it's possible in a way to have a kind of impartial jury, or that we can be an impartial jury of humanity. Punishing these crimes, but it's instead a kind of political concept that allows more powerful groups to maintain or gain power over less powerful groups. you might say, in the guise of claiming to speak for humanity. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that the way, you know, you're just sort of wanting to unmask, I guess, what purports to be a kind of abstract legalistic approach to crimes against, you know, this term humanity and give it a more political flavor. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right. That's accurate. I think so. Typically, when I presented this project to international lawyers or international criminal lawyers while I was developing it, it would usually go tremendously badly. It would usually go very poorly. So that wasn't a good experience. So perhaps to those who are still developing their PhD theses and their first books, you know, don't think too much of that. So if it goes poorly, there might be other reasons for that.
Don't interrupt. What was it? That sounds mean. Why did it go badly? What did they not like about?
Precisely because of the politics that you mentioned, right? So that's actually the point I was trying to get to. I get sidetracked by traumatic memories.
I see. They assume that you can have this impartial perspective.
Or rather,
you're rejecting that.
Yeah, that, and I think in addition, so one thing that I think is really important about the legal history of crimes against humanity is that it was developed, you know, to enhance victim protection. So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, international lawyers think about these really big norms like genocide, crimes against humanity, from an angle that primarily understand law as protective and progressive. That law and that international human rights law and international criminal law is there to curtail state power, to limit state power, to control state power, and to protect certain normative goods and to protect individuals and groups. And the more law we have, the more progressive the international order is, and the better it will be. Even if it's violent, but that it's better violence if it's wielded in the name of the law. Now, that is sort of a problem that I have. And so coming back to the politics, I do think that the way humanity is used politically is often, yes, indeed, as a vehicle of, say, domination, and as also as a vehicle of intervention. And my findings have been that, yes, most of the time humanity is used in hegemonic ways by the more powerful over the less powerful. But as I was thinking, you know, preparing for our conversation, I thought maybe that's a problem because I use texts for the book. I don't study oral histories. I haven't done archival work, right? So the counter-hegemonic uses of humanity, and this is very important. Humanity is open and flexible and variegated enough. It's indeterminate enough a term that it also can be used in counter-hegemonic ways. And I try to speak about this in the conclusion, how humanity has been used to combat racism, apartheid, and slavery at the international legal level and at the level of international and transnational social advocacy as well. So humanity is open and variegated enough to be used in counter-hegemonic and hegemonic modes, but the counter-hegemonic uses of humanity, I've mostly found, you know, after the Second World War and then in the 2000s. But again, that may be a bias of the sources of the book. So, but by and large, it lends itself to both political projects. And yet, I think the sort of the common geopolitical dominances reproduce themselves in the uses of humanity, right? It will never be Burundi that intervenes in France on behalf of humanity. You know, it will never be Gabon that intervenes in Greece on behalf of humanity in the refugee camps. Okay, so and so similar uses also similar problems and hierarchies reproduce themselves in the discourses, political discourses of humanity.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Good. I mean, and so this helps clarify, I think, a little bit in general what I take to be the, you know, one of the questions I had about the thesis, which is exactly kind of what the critical target of the book is. Whether you're criticizing the sort of normative ideal of humanity as sort of aspirational ideal to live up to, you know, embodying some spirit of humanity, a collective, some kind of collective, you know, common community of everyone, or the way in which the norm is itself sort of cynically employed by the European powers. And so it sounds like the latter, right? Okay. Yeah.
It's the latter. If I may add on to that. So this is a really important question you're raising, and it's fair. And I don't know how good my answer is to this. Again, you know, I think we also should own up to our answers that aren't very good. So you asked me, you know, is it about a critique of the normative ideal, or is it a critique about the deployments of the ideal? I almost want to say, I want to say that there's no strong distinction between the two. So I primarily in the book look at not how can humanity be justified, or is it, you know, is that something normatively desirable? I will say something about that in a moment. But to me, humanity is real insofar as it is used in texts, in arguments, in discourses, right? So I wanted to know, how have political theorists actually used and deployed the idea? And then what can we draw from those practical uses in theoretical texts, if you want to put it that way? How's humanity put to work? And that's what interested me. And that's when I find we see basically hypocrisy at work. Maybe not so much cynicism, but hypocrisy. Maybe that's a more useful term to think about it. Now, something that came to me after I finished the book, actually, is that, and this is, I didn't have this idea by myself. It was actually James Ingram who told me that. That what I'm overlooking in the book, and he's entirely right in saying that, is that humanity as a normative ideal can be an important horizon for particular struggles to, and again, counter-hegemonic struggles to couch their goals in a more universalistic way. And that is something I wasn't attentive to while I was writing the book. I should be very honest about that as well. So yes, I think there is something about humanity that can animate, you know, struggles that we see as good and valuable and progressive and anti-imperialist. And that's something I should think about more, basically.
Okay, good. Yeah, because I want to get, I mean, people who have listened to this podcast in full know that I've been on a Kant, stint recently. So I have Kant on the brain, so I have to apologize.
Don't apologize. Yes,
but one of the great thinkers of who invokes the notion of humanity. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I have somebody like him mm-hmm. in mind, right? Which is, Kant's, famously invokes, develops the idea of the dignity of humanity, for example. Humanity is an end in itself. And not just as a kind of norm mm-hmm. to restrict our maxims, as it were, but mm-hmm. as a kind of a teleological end of our moral mm-hmm. Political development,
yeah.
Right? As a striving towards some kind of kingdom of ends, mm-hmm. right? So you have an objection to a Kantian view too, or no?
I'm not sure if I have an objection. I think I have a worry about it, or I have a concern about it, or maybe I have a problem with it. Let's put it that way. So I'm not against the universalism of humanity per se, but I think it is a practical question, a question that I'm not quite able to answer, but I think it's important. So do we think that, every universalism is to some extent politically constituted? Or is there a universal that lacks this anchoring in the political? And what I mean by that is, maybe a less fancy way of putting that, a more blunt way of putting this is, is every universal in the end a universalization of a particular? And to put it like really, really polemically, then the question is, is every universal in the last instance, does it have an imperial gesture in it? So those are, I think, important questions. Now, when I say that, when I raise the question, is every universal in the end, is it politically constituted, or should we study the political constitution of the universal? Then I don't mean in the Schmittian sense, existential combat till death, and otherwise life is meaningless. I mean that's definitely not what I'm going for. But nonetheless, the question is, can the universal supersede the particular? So let's get back to humanity then. So I just mentioned that, I didn't pay enough attention in the book that humanity can be an important universal horizon for certain struggles. But whose struggle then is it? Yeah. So for instance, the Iraq War, I think what was really interesting about that, and I take a lot here from Aicha Chibukchu's book, 2008, the For the Love of Humanity on the World Tribunal on Iraq, what she finds in her fieldwork, and as much as she is also a philosopher, is that the Iraq War was defended in the name of humanity, and it was transnationally opposed in the name of humanity as well. The same vocabulary of humanity, of human rights, of crimes against humanity was used to defend the war against Iraq, and it was used in anti-imperialist critiques against the war in Iraq. So that's, it comes down to a practical question. How is humanity used? How it is deployed? What are the oppositions that it invites? And then the question is, do we see, again, uses, deployments of humanity that do not invite this kind of opposition? Yeah? So that to me is the question. And then if we really want to think about humanity, then what about climate destruction? So supposedly we live in the Anthropocene. Humanity has produced the conditions of its own ecological collapse. Do we see any action on that? No. Will we? No. No, right? So, I mean, I live in the tropics. The tropics will be the first to go because we don't have seasonal variation. We're getting hotter. And I mean, the weather is getting hotter. The climate is getting wetter. So similarly with the pandemic, if the pandemic has not awoken us to humanity, and if we're still patenting vaccines, then I'm not sure what are we waiting for? You know, like when is, I mean, kingdom of ends, I think we're ready for it, but it's just not really happening practically at the moment, you know? So
yeah, no, Kant said this might happen in thousands of years. So he's got quite a gradualist view, but yeah, I mean, I would hope that, I guess this is my hope, mm-hmm. my optimistic side, I would hope that there that those disagreements, conflicts over what is humanity are not interminable among human beings, that we could eventually, there's some possibility of reconciliation. I guess that's what I worry with a view like yours, okay. just in the sense that mm-hmm. it sort of forecloses the possibility of eventual reconciliation mm-hmm. ultimately. But I can see, I mean, I also am a fan of Herder, one of Kant's great critics, mm-hmm. who also developed the idea of humanity, by the by, mm-hmm. and you know, held a view that this, you know, his kind of universal rationality was very Eurocentric, right? I mean, that it just didn't sort of attend to the many manifold differences among human beings and human communities. So I'm of two minds of this, I guess.
Yeah, we could probably talk about this endlessly. I mean, perhaps, you know, another question is, you know, does humanity have to come to itself universally, or can it come through itself through particular projects of self-determination? Yeah. That's so, and perhaps, I mean, my thinking about this also has involved, you know, has evolved living in different parts of the world, and not least, you know, living in a very particular place in Southeast Asia. That's actually, I mean, this is quite close to my heart, this place here. And I have these conversations with my students every day. You know, they think universal human rights is crazy. I mean, not all of them, okay, right? But every once in a while, somebody says, you know, I don't think this is a good idea, you know? So, of course, some are also very convinced and very interested. But so perhaps I'm a little chastened by having it moved around in the world so much, but that's a different story.
Yeah, good, good. Not anymore. this is great, yeah, but to sort of get back to your book on the Because I want to get into what, you know, get into your thesis, as it were, sort of how it is on your view that, you know, European thinkers tend to use the notion of Europe, mm-hmm. universal crime in particular, and how they use it to establish a hierarchy. So the first chapter, you know, you sort of do the conceptual work and discussing, mm-hmm. yeah, analyzing right. the notion of universal mm-hmm. crime. And so maybe you could just say a little bit. I mean, you've already sort of introduced it, but maybe, you know, discuss it. Any other details that you want to discuss, and how then, you know, this idea of universal crime works to shore up the hierarchy of European powers, or hegemony of European powers over non-Europeans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I'm happy to do so. Maybe I can also sort of weave in sort of the idea that I had about inclusionary Eurocentrism in this answer. Let's see how it goes. So essentially, what I think the notion of universal crime does at the very sort of foundational level, or let's stick with crimes against humanity because it's more explicatory of what I'm trying to say, the actual phrase, because it has the actual words in it. So I think what a phrase like an offense against mankind, or an injury to humanity, or a crime against humanity, what these phrases presuppose is that humanity, on the one, first, humanity is normatively unified. Humanity is normatively one. It's not actually empirically one. It's normatively projected as a unified subject. Because if it's not a normative subject, then we cannot have a crime against it, right? You cannot commit a crime against gravity by jumping off the floor, because gravity is a fact of nature and you cannot offend it normatively. So the very fact that there's a crime against something mean that the something is a normative good. So a crime against humanity therefore presupposes, or entails, if you wish, humanity as a normatively unified subject. That's number one. Number two is that now enter the criminal against humanity. The criminal against humanity definitely is a part of this normative community. But the criminal, of course, it inhabits a position in the symbolic order of the law that is less desirable than the law abider, The criminal is a little bit less the law abider. The criminal is a little bit less good than the law enforcer. The criminal is a subject that's reduced in rights and entitlements, and this basically has done something bad. So then we enter a vision of humanity that is hierarchical. So the first feature of, you know, any kind of formulation of universal crime or crime against humanity is that humanity is normatively unified as one. Secondly, we need a criminal against humanity who is less entitled, less well-regarded, less well-protected than the law-abiding or the law enforcer. So the criminal is, you know, inhabits an unequal position compared to the one that it claims to enforce humanity's law. So we have a hierarchy woven into humanity then as a result. So that's sort of the first feature that I think is important to understand about how the concept works generally. Then thirdly, perhaps, what is also important then is that crimes against humanity, as it operates in political theoretical discourses and texts, is that it also has an authorizing function attached to it. And this authorizing function works as follows. Well, if all of humanity is injured, then everybody's injured, I'm injured, and therefore I am entitled to enforce humanity's law because I'm a member of humanity, right? And I have, as a member of the collective that is humanity, I am equally injured just as anybody else, and therefore I also have the entitlement to wield coercion in response to an offense against humanity. So that's the triad of how claims to universal crime typically work out. Now, how does this work to shore up the hierarchy between typically, you know, the way it works out in the colonial and imperial history of political thought? How does this work to shore up hierarchies between Europeans and non-Europeans? So pretty much in similar ways as I just explained in the abstract. So, you know, we need some sort of an offense against humanity, we need an offender against humanity, and we need the one who enforces humanity's or defends humanity's laws. So in Locke, it works the following way. Okay, so God gave the earth to humanity as a whole to be held in common, but then God didn't just give it to humanity just so as a gift, it gave it to humanity with the intention that the earth be cultivated for humanity to flourish. Now, cultivating the earth for Locke means something very particular. And of course, this has an English background as well, his argument. But for Locke, basically, this means agriculture. This means using the plow. Not to get into that too much. So, but then if you just let the earth lie idle, then you waste the potential of the earth. Thereby, you waste God's gift to humanity and you take away from what could be humanity's, because the fruits that could be earned from the earth by way of agriculture, you're not producing them. You're withholding that from humanity. You're insulting God's gift and you are taking away from humanity. Thereby, you are an offender against humanity. And then, of course, he conveniently disregarded the fact that he knew that Indigenous Americans, Native Americans also practice agriculture, but he pretended that they didn't and then said, well, look, here is the, so in chapter 5 where of the second treatise where references to universal crime are most dense, similarly, the references to the Native American are most dense as well. The Native American also immediately makes an entrance in the beginning of the second treatise as an illustration of the universal criminal in paragraphs, 6 and 7, and where he also introduces the universal natural executive right as the right to enforce the law of nature and to wield coercion legitimately in the state of nature. So that's typically, so that's kind of how it works. And I think I go back a little bit to, you know, looking at what's the particular that's universalized here, right? For Locke, it is the development of the earth, the bringing to fruition the earth's potential by particular practices. And that he says, this must be upheld. And if people don't do this, then humanity is offended and an authorization for those who comply with humanity's law is derived from that claim to a universal crime.
Yeah, so that's good. I mean, to pivot into Locke, because this is, you know, this is where you start your historical survey, as it were, of the mm-hmm. development of universal crime and European thinking. And Locke is a great place to begin, because he's just, his discussion about the earth belonging to humanity in common is very fascinating to me, and I know to many other readers, in part because Locke is often associated with the, you know, as the father of capital, the forefather of, you know, founding father of capitalism or whatever, you know, but yet he has this moment of, you know, the common, the commons belonging to everyone here at the beginning, which should exert some influence. In any case, yeah, so I'd love to talk about Locke here for a minute. I mean, the first thing that occurs to me off the that, just to sort of get started in this, is I wonder what you think in terms of the sort of Christian roots of this.
Yeah.
I mean, in mm-hmm. just in the sense that just the kind of historical background, maybe I'm not sure how much philosophical mm-hmm. significance it has, but in terms of the way in which it's, you know, universal crime, the universality of it, the sort of legalism of it, there's a way in which the sort of Christian element in Locke is, you know, this, it makes it possible and it makes it very, you know, relevant to have mm-hmm. Have this at the forefront. What do you think?
Oh, interesting. You say it makes it possible. That's actually very useful. So you are completely right in asking this question. It's important and it's fair. It's caused me a lot of trouble. And that's actually why I don't start with Vittoria and or Las Casas, to be honest, because they were a little bit too Christian for me. And as my colleague William Bain has conclusively demonstrated, I would say, is that you cannot take somebody like Vittoria, divest his political thought of its theological substance, and still use it as though it's coherent in order to talk about contemporary issues of humanitarian intervention or the responsibility to protect. So William Bain says that is not possible due to the constitutively theological nature of Vittoria's thought. I actually think that, I have a slight objection to that, but that's not our problem. So with Locke and Christianity, so the problem here typically is that people say, well, for Locke, there was no humanity. For Locke, there was only humanity. For Locke, there was no humanity. There was only Christianity. So for people like Locke, there is no universal community of mankind. There's only a community of Christendom, of Christians. And sort of the role of the infidels and the non-believers, I mean, they must be, that must be explored separately. I'm not too sure. So that's always been a little bit of a problem. On the other hand, I think the other question then is, all right, so if this kind of universalism of humanity was originally Christian in the Western tradition, say, then do we see it secularized at some point or not? Can we ever say that allusions to humanity are fully secularized, or is there always a latent and irreducible transcendent nature of humanity? So the question of Christianity and secularism has caused me a lot of trouble. But perhaps the way you put it is actually quite nice. The fact that, you know, there is something like a aspiration to universal Christendom in Locke is something that enables him to argue in these universalist terms in the first place. I like that much better. I'm not sure if that answered your question, but maybe I should.
No, it does. Not to bring it back to Kant again, but the way in which there's a sort of Christian, I mean, this might maybe my Nietzsche side too coming out, but the sort of Christian, the pervasiveness of sort of Christian categories into this way of thinking, that it's about a law, a transcendent law that's applied to a community at large, a universal community that didn't exist before Christianity, right? And yet, you know, calls for a kind of a perspective from nowhere, right? Which is a sort of divine perspective. And in any case, so, you know, that's all to say that it seems to me that, you know, the sort of Christian roots of this are there, but I mean, the secular, Locke surely is an important figure in the secularization of this.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Good. So I think you raised the term inclusionary Eurocentrism. You referred to it a couple minutes ago. I thought, maybe, you know, this may be a good place to sort of get into that a little bit more, because you in your development of, you know, Locke's view and his use of universal crime, he represents a certain type of a way of you know, using the, it's a form of inclusion, you know, the Native Americans are included as part of humanity, but it's also Eurocentric though at the same time. So maybe you could just, you know, sort of develop that idea of inclusionary Eurocentrism.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. Let's see if I can still string it together sufficiently well. What was I thinking? So I think that the departure point is twofold, honestly. First is, you know, the basic thought that just because something is declared universal doesn't mean it cannot be Eurocentric. So, and then I will get to the two types of Eurocentrism that I observed in a moment. This argument turns a little bit, or not a little bit, this argument turns again, sort of pivots away from Jennifer Pitts's claim that it is really only in the 19th century that we can observe a solid turn to Eurocentrism in international legal thinking or in international political theory, as she's argued, demonstrates in her book, The Boundaries of the International. And reading that, I thought that's really interesting to me, and I take a lot from her, and her work's been really important for thinking through mine and developing mine. But I thought that this wasn't quite right, that, you know, that we observe sort of a Eurocentric constriction of international thinking in the 19th century. That I thought wasn't quite the point. So inclusive Eurocentrism versus exclusionary Eurocentrism. It's very much about how the relationship between humanity and law is conceptualized. And this connection between the two is really important for understanding the distinction. So maybe I'll start with exclusionary Eurocentrism, because that might be a little bit easier to understand, to get into it. So in the 19th century, as sort of positivism begins to reform natural law thinking, or begins to transform natural law thinking, doesn't replace it, but begins to change it. So the way 19th century international political theorists and jurists were thinking about international law is that law can only apply to societies. Law can only apply to civilizationally similar units. Law can only apply to a community of civilized nations. Being a state wasn't enough in the 19th century. Anthony Enge has demonstrated that conclusively, and I think authoritatively at this point. So 19th century international theorists were thinking, well, international law only applies between civilized nations. It doesn't matter if you're a state, doesn't matter if you're Japan, that was sort of a border case. So, and that's sort of the exclusionary Eurocentrism there, is that, okay, international law operates between European polities, and it doesn't extend to non-European polities. It doesn't protect non-European polities, but it also doesn't bind them either. It also doesn't obligate them either. So the ambit, the area of international law, if you want to imagine it that way, sort of does become constricted towards the, or onto the European, inner European relations. So John Stuart Mill has made maybe the most famous statement here, is that, you know, that the law of non-intervention only applies between European polities as a product of international law, whereas, you know, the relationships between European polities and non-European societies is governed by mere morality only, but not by international law, properly speaking, as it became to be consolidated as a discipline in the 19th century. So that's what I mean by exclusionary Eurocentrism, that literally certain norms and laws don't apply to non-European peoples, and they are sort of reserved for the European center of the world. Now, inclusionary Eurocentrism sort of works a little bit differently. It works, let's say, you know, and let's use Locke again. It works in ways to say, yeah, so certain norms are universal. They apply to everyone without consent, non-consensually, because these are universal norms. They don't require, agreement from anybody in order to be valid. So these norms apply universally. Therefore, they protect universally, but they also obligate universally. So hence, you know, to develop the earth is a universal imperative, and, you know, it protects those who do it, but it also renders those liable who don't do it. And the inclusionary Eurocentrism here is that everybody's included in this normative imagination of the world and this normative universe, but it's Eurocentric still because what is stipulated as a universal is a particular Eurocentric idea of how human beings have to behave and how societies ought to be structured in order to be fair, just, and legitimate. So that's the distinction. You know, the question is, do we cast a worldwide vision of the law and then impose, you know, specific norms as universal? That's inclusionary Eurocentrism. Or do we just really say, okay, law only operates between these particular actors and not between others? Like, this, you know, law belongs to Europe, and the rest of the world can just have morality. That's exclusionary Eurocentrism.
Yeah. So that's which kind is?
Of, yeah.
No, that's good. Go ahead. That's good. I mean, that's very helpful. I mean, it sort of distinguishes two different kinds of Eurocentrism, which is a very useful distinction. I mean, I wonder, for your purposes, which is the more powerful in terms of establishing European hegemony, I suppose they assert that power in different ways.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but I wish I had. That's a really good way to think about it. I want to say that I'm not sure which one is more important. I think they're just different. The claims of dominance are different. On the one hand, so it's a claim of justification, right? So something I like to say sometimes is, I'm not going to say that now, that will distract us. The question is, you know, are certain forms of coercion, intervention, are they justified in the name of a law, or are they justified in the name of something else? Are they justified in terms of, you know, racial hierarchies or civilizational hierarchies, racialized hierarchies? Are they justified in terms of, you know, these people are underdeveloped, they cannot take care of themselves, they need tutelage, you know, that we need to lift them up to breathe the air of full human development? Is that the kind of the justification for outsider coercive intervention and the restructuring, forceful restructuring of societies? Or are these kinds of actions performed explicitly in the name of a law, explicitly as a normative endeavor to realize certain norms or normative ideals? So I think there is some kind of difference between the two. Which one is more important? I'm not sure. They're just different. Maybe a distinction that may help, but maybe it doesn't. So remember the NATO intervention in Libya, right, in 2011? So that was the one time, unless I'm underinformed or I missed something, that was the one time that the Security Council actually sat down and first referred the Libyan situation to the International Criminal Court and then authorized intervention, such that when NATO did intervene, it was already a international criminal situation. And NATO was explicitly normatively acting as a global policing actor, as a police force, as a law enforcement agency almost, rather than as a fashion of warfare, right? So the question then is, it's military force all the same, but then it's the question, you know, is military force wielded in the name of international law, or is military force wielded in the name of, you know, let's, you know, protect women because, you know, they're not treated nicely? So it's domination and coercion all the same. But what is the track of justification that drives them? I think that's the difference. Which one's more important? I don't know.
My liberal side makes me think that the Lockean mm-hmm. one, at least the Lockean one, grants agency to the variety of different peoples across the earth, right? In the sense that they're all part of a legal community, right? Sure. And they're all responsible and answerable to the law. Whereas on a million conception, you know, you have to treat some of the some peoples like children, essentially, right? Who need to be dominated and or tutored and educated and so forth. So at least there's an understanding of the classical liberal view of the sort of universal rationality.
That is true. The question is, that a blessing or a curse,
right?
I suppose. It's something I try to also say in the book, that, you know, inclusion isn't always good. Inclusion can be a vehicle of domination, right? Inclusion can be predatory, can be rapacious, it can be disenfranchising. This is actually Jennifer Pitz's argument. And I thought that was very convincing in the boundaries of the international, is that if we only think about exclusion as a political problem, then we too easily think of inclusion as the fix for that, and that is not, that's insufficient. So it's nice to be recognized within the normative, within the symbolic order of a normative world, but then what are the liabilities that arise from that, right? So it's a double-edged sword. It works either way, so yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the treatment of Native Americans in Locke's the fifth chapter is, I mean, it's, as you were saying earlier in your description of Locke, is a great example of the, you know, ways in which that can be, you know, misused. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Yeah. I mean, I'm tempted to go down the rabbit hole a lot, but I'm going to resist. I'm going to resist it. Instead,
you're,
I mean,
just,
I wield my power judiciously. Instead I want to talk about Mill and Tocqueville because mm-hmm. exclusionary, Eurocentrism that you talk about.
Yeah.
Because I, you know, why don't you say a little bit about, you know, Mill and Tocqueville, the way that they conceive of, the use of European power and the sort of restriction mm-hmm. on European power, justified not in universal terms as mm-hmm. it would be in Locke, but but in eminently particularistic terms, right? In terms of the honor mm-hmm, yeah. or the shame of a particular mm-hmm. community, European community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good way of recapitulating already what I was trying to do. So this is the infamous chapter 3, which was kind of the hardest to do, honestly. So Milan Tocqueville. So what got me on the path of looking at Milan Tocqueville was that I noticed that in the 19th century, by and large, or in the second half of the 19th century, articulations and circulations of universal crime begin to decline. They kind of sort of fizzle out. They strangely go away, which is weird because that's the heyday of European imperialism. So my expectation was doing the work was, oh yeah, okay, this is, high stage of imperialism. Notions of crimes against humanity must explode. And then the opposite was the case. So I had a problem. And this problem also was there because the one issue around which universal crime and crimes against humanity, actually the actual phrase is used, is the abolition of slavery, is British abolitionism. So, but once I started looking at that, I realized that, okay, so some of the research on abolitionism demonstrates that the Brits actually, they were quite concerned about themselves. They were quite concerned about, their own position in the world, their own civilization. They were worried about what God thought about them enslaving other human beings. So some research on abolitionism basically says, oh yeah, the British called this a crime against humanity, but they thought that they were committing it, not the native over there far away in the colonies. So then I looked at Mill and Tocqueville. And what I found was that Mill, in his denunciation of the uprising in Moreton Bay in Jamaica, in British colonial Jamaica, and Tocqueville's assessment of colonialism in French colonialism in Algeria, was very much that they phrased these issues as, offenses against England, or sort of diminishing the diminishments of French glory and French prestige and the vitality of French national identity. So Mill, if we take Mill's reaction to the Moreton Bay issue, he phrased the problem as one of British politics and of British law. And that he said, well, the injuries suffered in Moreton Bay were suffered by British subjects. So in here, I think, so Jennifer Pitts and Daniel O'Neill have disagreed on the imperial and non-imperial value of Mill's argument. But there, basically, I realized in the 19th century, theorists begin to sort of turn towards their own polities as the subject that is injured or enhanced by colonial practices and by colonial violence as well, right? So in different ways. So that I thought was interesting. And hence, I think humanity sort of disintegrates into other concepts in the 19th century. It disintegrates into civilizational difference. It disintegrates into national character, into differences between national character, and then ultimately into racism and scientific racism. So that the sort of the idea of a unified humanity that could be injured as a whole begins to fizzle out because these other concepts come in, such as nationality, sovereignty, national character, civilization, race, and Mill and Tocqueville are exponents of that kind of thinking.
The way in which I tend to think of humanity coming in and those two thinkers is precisely the way in which, kind of that they conceive of those countries as, I guess, torchbearers of humanity, in some way that, mm-hmm. you think about the ways mm-hmm. in which, Mill, on Liberty, say, we'll talk about utility uh-huh. as the, what does he refer to it as, the progressive mm-hmm. tendency of humanity or something. I think he uses that term mm. humanity, right?
Okay.
I'd have to look at the text. I'm just sort of quoting from memory here, but it's, it strikes me when thinking about this, right? And you're thinking about how, say, England has a, great, moral error, that it's mm-hmm. not just the moral error that affects them. They're holding back the march of humanity that they're leading. I mean, that's the crucial mm-hmm. point, that they're leading into the future. Whereas for Tocqueville, mm-hmm. In the introduction to Democracy in America, he has this mm-hmm. wonderful account of the providential development of democracy in the world mm. and among, I say humanity broadly understood. And, mm-hmm. So France, it would be, here we need, you need to have the right colonial imperial policy in France in order to have democracy right, in order for humanity to progress. I'm not sure if that resonates at all, but it occurs to me that's it's at least they don't, those thinkers, it doesn't seem to me lose humanity entirely in the way that you lose it in, say, a racialized 19th century thinker.
I think that's true. Yeah, I think that's right. That is still a little bit too early, and they don't work with these, you know, these rigid, reified notions of race. Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, like Cecil Rhodes, I teach Cecil Rhodes here. So based on what you said about Mill and the British as the torchbearers of humanity, I mean, Rhodes still makes an argument for the universal British Empire. Like, he's still very upset that the fact that universal British Empire didn't come through, right? So, and he also thinks about the world as unified, but the world ought to be unified under the British flag. So there is a universalism, and so I teach the Confessions of Faith. So yeah, you are right. It is there, but say it's refracted differently, right? Humanity is refracted, say, through nationalism and through imperial nationalism. That's the other important part, then, that nationalism in the 19th century isn't just domestic nationalism. It's explicitly a nationalism that drives imperial expansion, and where sort of imperial identity and national identity in the center in Europe become intertwined. So that's an interesting way actually to recast my argument. Yeah, I could have put it that way as well. That perfectly makes sense.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, second edition, you can take that.
Yeah, new and improved.
Added appendix. Yeah. So the chapter four, you know, shifting, you know, come to the end points of your historical account here into the 20th century with contemporary thinkers, especially Habermas. And I wanted to get to Habermas. You focus on Habermas, but Habermas, you know, just from our discussion here, is such an interesting figure, because he both has this kind of liberal Kantian universalism side that you could say that's the heritage of Locke, and hence the inclusionary Eurocentrism. But he also has, and this is like Amy Allen's recent book, what is that, The End of Progress? Her recent book where she criticizes Habermas for still having proto, you know, the 19th century philosophy of history stuff that we were just talking about embedded his developmental psychology that he relies on. Mm-hmm. So he has, in a way, kind of, you know, also that exclusionary Eurocentrism in it, might say. So maybe I could say a little bit about, I mean, introduces the Habermas. I'm not sure where you want to begin, but you know, you have this account of the way he reacted to particular policies, say the NATO bombing in Kosovo and then the Iraq War. Yeah. If you want to start there, maybe, and then we can work towards his explaining that in the context of his cosmopolitan theory.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, great. That's a great starter. I just said that chapter three was the hardest. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe chapter four was the hardest. They were both terribly hard. So Habermas, I thought, was interesting. And perhaps I'm a little bit parochial here, because I am, of course, you know, in the end, I was raised in Germany, and he is a German in the end. So I found all of that quite intriguing. So let's start with two things that I thought were interesting about Habermas. So first, what intrigued me, again, politically, was that he was so enthusiastic about, as you rightly say, the 1999 NATO intervention in Kosovo. And then he was so opposed to the US-led 2003 war in Iraq. And what I found interesting was that he had this very stark distinction between the two military operations, even though both of them were, you know, against international law. Strictly speaking, under a strict reading of international law, and a strict reading of the United Nations Charter, they were both equally illegal. But he was one of those people who said, well, yeah, Kosovo might have been illegal, but it was legitimate. It was justified. Iraq was not. So that was sort of the political issue that I thought was interesting. But then that's not all. What he then does is to actually mount a sophisticated and at the same time completely ill-informed theoretical defense of that distinction. And that was what interested me even more. I say ill-informed because he actually doesn't know what the laws of war are. He uses them completely wrongly. He confuses the use at bellum with the use in bello. He doesn't know what a war crime is. So, but that even isn't interesting to me, because that's even more fascinating, that he doesn't even know what these terms mean, but he uses them to make a particular point. Yeah. So, and that to me just made it all the more enticing to look into it. So Habermas then mounts a defense of Kosovo, And he develops his cosmopolitanism further in response to this case, but he does it only, and he can only do it by way of crimes against humanity. He cannot do it by international human rights law. He cannot do it by human rights. And that I thought was really fascinating, and probably nobody else is interested in this. I think chapter 4 is the one that will be least read. So if you're listening to this, I authorize you not to read it if you just don't want to do it. But so, right. So Habermas has a longstanding, huge work, an oeuvre, so to speak, about the deliberative authorization of law. So, right, so deliberative democracy and rule of law has to go together. Human rights and democratic participation, they are one. They have to come in one piece. Otherwise, we look at distortions of political power that one or another are illegitimate. Okay, so now he has the huge problem, of course, when he's looking at issues of warfare, when he's looking at issues of civil war, of atrocities, of foreign military intervention, there is no democracy in that point. Democracy, there is no political institutions, there's no deliberation. There is no political participation, especially in countries that, you know, don't have strong democratic systems, as he imagines them anyways, who don't have these systems to begin with, or not yet. So the nexus between deliberative democracy and human rights authorization is broken in the situation of Kosovo. And yet he defends it. And that's when he has to turn to crimes against humanity. That's when he has to go away from rights, which he has written about forever. And then he has to turn to the idea of a universal crime. And he says, well, this is all justified anyways, even though none of my earlier democratic theories and my theories of the rule of law, which I spent decades developing, even though none of this holds, this act of coercion, this act of violence, this war, essentially, that NATO waged in the Balkans, it's still justified because there were crimes against humanity. And therefore, NATO is this exponent of a cosmopolitan law enforcer. And then he does seriously say that what we see in the NATO intervention is this sort of this encapsulation and sort of an oncoming of a future cosmopolitan order. This is the incipience of it, he basically says. And that I thought was complicated and difficult, because I mean it's still an act of warfare, right? I mean it's still an act of military coercion, and under the fog of war, actually the civil war escalated even further, like let alone the typical collateral damage that happens in these kinds of interventions. So that's where Habermas's cosmopolitanism really hinges on crimes against humanity, not on human rights, but also where sort of I think the tacit bellicosity of cosmopolitanism comes out, because cosmopolitanism really isn't pacifism. It's not, you know, it's not that Habermas comes out against military coercion. That's not what he's doing. He's all for it, as long as it responds to crimes against humanity, because that apparently magically wipes away all sorts of other institutional or legalistic concerns that we might otherwise have. So that's what I think is really interesting in the late Habermas, as incoherent as he sometimes can be then. Yeah.
That's good. I mean, one of the things that occurred to me in thinking about how mm-hmm. maybe to mount a defense of Habermas in this. I obviously can't weigh in on the particular cases here, but just thinking more generally, and yeah. I mean, the way in which, you know, Habermas is sort of deliberative democracy mm-hmm. and the communicative rationality, there's a way in which that can generate more of more forms of inclusion, say, than a Lockean heritage, right? In the sense that, you know, if Locke's view is here is the natural law, you know, mm-hmm. Native Americans, this applies to you too. At least, you know, in a conception of deliberative democracy, norms have mm-hmm. to be justified to agents that you're in dialogue with, you know, mm-hmm. Through actual communication, right? So presumably in any kind of universal legal decision by mm-hmm. the UN or NATO, the affected party would have to have some kind of representation in the universal body, right? I mean, presumably mm-hmm. on Habermas's view, he wouldn't think that a global police force could just waltz into any country that's not represented by the UN or NATO, right? Or would he? I know.
I think he might be okay with that under certain conditions. So everything you just said, I'm on board with it. Everything you said, I think, is correct. What interests me a little bit more is when that breaks down, when we don't have conditions like that, and when we look at situations of large-scale violence and need to reflect on their political legitimacy, when we don't have these tools in place, when we don't have representation of the affected in place, when we don't have the democratic processes in place, the United Nations Security Council, my students are always, this is the first thing they know about the UN, just how unfair and how exclusionary it is. And it's just the countries that happened to win the Second World War. So I'm interested in what happens and how we think about legitimacy and coercion when all these conditions that we otherwise recognize as good, when they're not present. So, and I think what Habermas is doing desperately, he's engaging in crisis harmonization. He realizes that his political theory cannot justify Kosovo. So he goes into crisis mode, and then he has to harmonize what he wants to politically endorse, because he doesn't, it's just this typical thing. We cannot have genocide in Europe. Like, if it happens elsewhere, I was like, nah, well, oh, too bad, terrible. Okay, but you know, well, it's in Africa. I mean, what were we supposed to say? I mean, we couldn't possibly go there, could we? I mean, yeah, we could have jammed the radio waves, but nothing else, right? But we cannot have genocide in the backyard of Europe. Okay, so I think that's honestly his knee-jerk reaction, that he wants to endorse Kosovo, he wants to endorse NATO, but his political theory as it stands does not uphold it, and hence he has to harmonize this theoretical crisis. And that's when he turns to Crimes Against Humanity and says, and basically begins to use the vocabulary of international criminal law as opposed to international human rights law in order to say, this is where we observe the incipience of a cosmopolitan world order. So, and he can only say it through Crimes Against Humanity. So that's, I find that a little bit more stimulating, to be honest.
Yeah, we should this chapter 4, everybody should read it. I disagree with you, so.
Chapter 4, there it is.
So let's conclude. I mean, I wanted to conclude with kind of the two main points that you take up in the conclusion, which mm-hmm. bring up some broad kind of contemporary issues. The point you alluded to much earlier in the conversation, that this language of universal crime and crimes against humanity has mm-hmm. recently been taken up by counter hegemonic voices,
mm-hmm.
And marginalized voices, and in service to a kind of emancipatory politics. So mm-hmm. so I guess one of the questions I had for you, I mean, maybe you mm-hmm. can say a little bit about the examples of those kinds of individuals or groups, but also, mm-hmm. Is this in a way a potential for thinking about universal crime or crimes against humanity, that it can be a redeemed ideal after all, right? That it mm-hmm. emerged as a way to shore up European power, but it turns against Europeans in the way that, Marx talks about how mm-hmm. capital turns against capitalists and gets in the hands of proletariat, right? That it becomes uh-huh. sort uh-huh. of a dialectical undoing, their own dialectical undoing. Mm-hmm. Or is that my Kantian hopefulness coming out?
Oh, I'm fine with dialectics as long as we don't wait for the synthesis, I suppose. When I start giving examples now, I think that the oppositional forces will become clear very quickly. So, let me build this according to your question, and thank you for asking it. So counter-hegemonic uses of humanity and crimes against humanity that we have observed a little bit more recently. So I think, and I was trying to look at this on two levels. The first was instruments of international law created, as such as it is, international law, by states. So intergovernmental efforts to harness crimes against humanity for emancipatory purposes. So I think here it's really important that, so one example that I use is the Durban Declaration against racism and apartheid. I forget now when it was, early 2000s, I think. So of course it's in Durban, so that's significant, where, and this is an international legal document that basically says apartheid is a crime against humanity, slavery is a crime against humanity, and therefore we condemn it. And this is we need to think of apartheid as a crime against humanity. And a former colleague of mine, Victor Catan, who now works in Nottingham, he's actually doing the international legal research to show how over time apartheid has been more and more articulated as a crime against humanity. So that is sort of, I call this sort of, where crimes against humanity is used sort of for bottom-up purposes, to defend those who are subject to excessive power rather than to legitimize excessive power over others. So that's a use of crime against humanity where we see it used as a pushback against excessive coercion or forms of coercion, say, that we think is inherently wrong. Now, let me use the other example first. So on the one hand, there's stuff happening on the interstate level where crimes against humanity is used more explicitly to push back against coercive state power rather than enhance it as a legitimizer. The other example that I used was from the transnational social movement sphere, where I look at, again, Aicha Chibukchu's study of the World Tribunal Against Iraq, which was a tribunal staged in the tradition of the People's Tribunals. That comes in part out of the protest against the Vietnam War, where transnational social movement formed in protest against the Iraq War and said, you know, we as a transnational social movement, we speak in the name of humanity, and we accuse George W. Bush, we accuse Tony Blair of crimes against humanity perpetrated on the Iraqi people. Yeah. So similarly, that is a bottom-up approach where these very same terms are used in an anti-imperialist way. So those are sort of more emancipatory ways of using this. Now back to the question, you know, is this sort of, does this move into some sort of unified direction? I think this is really, really complicated a question because, of course, so if we think about crimes against humanity being apartheid being articulated as a crimes against humanity, of course, one of the issues where one of the areas in the world where apartheid is most contentiously at stake nowadays is, of course, is Israel-Palestine. And Noura Erekat has spoken eloquently about this. Her book recently, Justice for Some, speaks about this as well. So, and then the question again is, right, so is are we observing, you know, crimes against humanity? Are we observing apartheid? And then, I mean, the pushback immediately, you can imagine what's coming in, right? So in terms of opposition against using this kind of language in order to address the situation in Israel-Palestine. So, for the resolution, I'm not so sure. I think, again, we're observing a fluid and dynamic uses of humanity mobilized for a number of political projects that are oppositional in nature.
One of the uses of humanity, to get to the second point in your conclusion, is the is that the use of it in the context of climate change. Which, you know, often there's this, you see this, it's just sort of vague gesture towards, think about the future of humanity when you're using a plastic drinking straw or something like that. I'm not sure. Yeah. In any case, insofar as I take your point of the conclusion, I totally agree with it, which is that, this is much too much of a kind of abstraction here that we need to think about the specific institutional mechanisms for creating climate change and for solving it. And you point out how capitalism is, you know, one of the main drivers for climate change.
Yep.
We need to address that rather than appeal to the vagueness of humanity. Does that get it? Okay. Can you solve climate change for us or?
I wish as I'm running the AC, the aircon, what do you call it? We call it aircon in Singapore. I don't know. You call it AC, I think. So as I'm running AC, the AC, right? Yeah. So I think the problem with, you know, arguments is like, oh, humanity is at stake in climate change. So first of all, these arguments about the Anthropocene have been undone pretty well, I think, by arguments about the Capitalocene, where the humanity hasn't created climate destruction. It's capital accumulation, driven by the burning of fossil fuels and by the consumption of the products of the burning of fossil fuels. That is what has driven climate destruction, right? So the argument of the Anthropocene is, oh, humanity, you know, after the Industrial Revolution has become one unified geological force. Deepesh Chakrabarty writes about that in the 10 thesis or 12 thesis on climate change, however many theses he had. So that's not true. Humanity is not a geophysical force. It's particular actors that act in a particular way, that do particular things, and people who consume particular products, right? So, so similarly, humanity is not going to be evenly affected by climate change. It's, you know, I mean, 2 degrees warming or 2.5 degrees global heating, that's just an average. some parts of the world will heat up exponentially. Other parts of the world will get cooler. The Gulf Stream will move away from England. England will, the British Isles, it will probably get cooler. Humanity is not evenly affected by any of this. And then, of course, the poor cannot protect themselves, whereas the rich can buy out by way of insurances or extra protection or by way of purchasing mobility. So again, it's a sort of, you know, to say something affects humanity, I think to some extent is always just some sort of overshadowing of the concrete actors that do particular things in particular settings and systems. So humanity never acts. People act in the name of humanity. Humanity is a claim. It's a claim to something that is larger than us and that is unified, can be good or bad, but humanity never acts. We can only act in the name of humanity. And that's an important thing that I wanted to undo in the book. It's like whenever somebody uses humanity, like ask what specifically they're doing and what their project is. And then you can sort of understand deployments of humanity and the operations of power that inhere the concept.
That seems right to me. One of the books I really liked in thinking about this notion is Samuel Scheffler, the philosopher, has one of his recent books is Why Worry About Future Generations? I had him on the podcast a couple of years ago, but one of his more recent, I think about it in the context of your work, because he, in his recent work on the afterlife, this sort of secularized notion of the afterlife he develops,
that's cool.
One of the things that he's after is to reveal how all of us have a sort of implicit love of humanity. This is in fact what he says in the recent book, that we all have a love of humanity. It's not love for, I mean, we may have love for particular peoples or our family or particular individuals, but we also more fundamentally have a love of humanity, that we want humanity as a species to continue so that the projects that we are engaged in don't lose meaning. Is that, you know, the various projects that we have always have an afterlife in the traditions of humanity that live after us. So we have an interest in humanity living on. And so in any case, I raised that as a way of thinking about, I don't know if this intersects with your thinking at all. I mean, you're more skeptical of this invocation, but he's much more affirmative of this invocation of, you know, thinking about humanity as an inheritance that we've received from the past and that we can pass on into the future. And that can have, in his view, some kind of power. Probably, I mean, he certainly wouldn't say it would be sufficient to defeat climate change, it's at least something. I don't know if that what you think about that.
That's interesting. I mean, I think my first question, so I didn't know about this argument. That's another thing one should always admit not knowing something. My first question would be, okay, so then what actions does it inspire? What are the practices that emerge from this love for humanity? What concretely can we observe where, you know, love for humanity is deployed discursively and we can see something concretely happening from that? So again, I would want to see something a little bit more practical, which is weird because we're theorists, but nonetheless, I do think it's very, very difficult for us to imagine. I mean, look, I mean, the planet is going to be fine with climate destruction. We're not going to be fine. Human beings, we can't live. The planet's going to do its thing. You know, the fish are going to be dead, whatever. That's going to be around. It's not going to implode or turn into dust or anything. In addition, you know, there are these projections that if all people disappeared from the earth today, what, it's like 212 years and the Eiffel Tower is invisible due to vegetation or something, right? So we have to constantly fight back against nature overshadowing us. Actually, in Singapore, you see this all the time. There's an army of people that cut back the tropical forests every single day, right? Otherwise, we would be all, you know, waiting around here in trees. So I think it's very difficult for us to imagine the world without us in it as a human species. So that I do find interesting. So that probably does speak to the fact that, you know, I do have attachments to humanity and its persistence. Just the fact that I find it difficult to imagine the globe without us on it. So again, I guess my question to Samuel would be, okay, what are the concrete patterns of action that we can observe as an outcome of this love, right? So, right, loving is not a state of emotion, it's a form of action, right? So as your next relationship therapist would say. So that would be the first question I would ask.
That's good, yeah. Well, I'll bring him back on. We can hash it out together. Right. That'd be fun. Well, anyway, Zinnia, it's been great to talk to you. It's really fun.
And you as well.
Time to talk to you tonight.
Thanks
again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
On the contrast, thank you very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.